From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Senate Democrats blocked a Republican police reform bill from advancing, calling it an inadequate response to police violence. The House will vote on its proposal tomorrow.
Meanwhile, if early results from yesterday's primaries are a sign of what's to come in November, people who are currently holding office should be worried. Progressive Democrats say a wave of support lifted their candidates in some of the five states where the polls were open amid social unrest and a pandemic that has led to a surge of mail-in voting that is delaying results. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson has been poring over these results. And Mara, let's start with New York. Longtime Congressman Elliot Engel appears to be losing by double digits to the progressive newcomer Jamal Bowman and Carolyn Maloney. These are both senior Democrats, barely ahead of her challenger, Suraj Patel. What is the message, do you think, that Democratic voters are sending?
I think that the message Democratic voters are sending in these very blue districts is that they want their representatives to move to the left. The center of gravity in the Democratic Party is moving left, maybe not as far and as fast as the center of gravity in the Republican Party moved to the right. But there's no doubt that the base of the Democratic Party, which is extremely energized this year, is voting for newer, younger, more progressive Democrats. They aren't huge ideological issues, but this is very much like the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez versus Crowley race. He was a member of the leadership. She was young. She was Latina. And so I think that that's the trend in Democratic districts. What we haven't seen yet is very progressive candidates, the kind of candidates that Bernie Sanders and AOC would endorse, flipping a red district blue. That we haven't seen yet. But in this, these super blue districts, there are older establishment Democrats who are in danger of losing their seats in a primary.
Well, speaking of trying to flip a red seat blue, let's talk about what's been happening in Kentucky, where they're trying to figure out which Democrat is going to challenge Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. In November, there was a primary yesterday, and it looks like Charles Booker, who's Kentucky's youngest black state lawmaker, is doing pretty well in the early results against Amy McGrath, who was endorsed by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. What do you see happening there?
Amy McGrath is the establishment candidate. Nobody expected Charles Booker to surge in the way that he has. He's an unabashedly progressive candidate. He's had a very powerful message. He runs ads talking about from the hood to the holler. In other words, he's going to unite a coalition of low-income white rural Kentuckians and inner-city African-Americans. I don't think that either McGrath or Booker have much of a chance to unseat Mitch McConnell. He's the majority leader in the Senate, has a pretty firm grip on a seat. Kentucky is a very red state. But Charles Booker's surge really surprised everyone. Amy McGrath represents the kind of thinking in the Democratic Party that the only way you win in a red state is to be pretty centrist. She's a military veteran. She, you kind of stay in the middle and you hope that you can kind of thread the needle. Charles Booker has a different approach. He's a progressive. He thinks that you can unite people who are hurting economically, whether they are culturally progressive or not, from the hood to the holler. That's what he thinks.
On the Republican side, there was a primary in 24-year-old newcomer Madison Cawthorn, who was not endorsed by President Trump, won anyway in a runoff race in North Carolina to fill Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' seat. This breaks a streak that President Trump had where all the candidates he had endorsed were winning their primaries.
That's right. This is a very red district. It's not going to flip. It's just an insult to Trump. You know, it kind of stings. Trump, of course, turned around right away and congratulated him. Really young guy, as you said, 24-year-old newcomer, Madison Cawthorn. He's partially paralyzed because of a automobile accident. But yes, it just takes some of the shine off of Trump. And it seems like, no, he doesn't have complete control over his party.
Now, the reason that we don't have these results in a lot of cases today is because of a lot of mail-in voting, because of the pandemic. What do you see when you look at that and think about what will happen on election night in November? It may not be clear who wins the night of the election because of all the mail-in ballots.
That's right. We probably, it's very possible that we won't have a winner on election night. And I think there's going to be a big effort to educate people that even if that is the case. We have to wait a little while. It doesn't mean that the election is illegitimate. You know, Donald Trump has been saying a lot of things about mail-in ballots, saying that they represent huge fraud, which is not backed up by any evidence. And as a matter of fact, Republican officials in many red states and swing states want to use mail-in ballots and think they're fine. But Donald Trump has been very adamant. Over and over again, he said that if we have mail-in voting, the election will be rigged. So I just think people have to get ready. We're not necessarily going to know who wins the presidential election on the evening of November 3rd.
Just briefly, Mara, this defeat in the Senate today, Democrats blocking the Republican bill on police reform. The House is going to vote on its bill tomorrow. Do you see them being able to come together and make something happen here?
That is really unclear. I think a lot of this depends on the president. A week ago, or 2 weeks ago, he seemed very eager to sign a police reform bill. He immediately got on board with Tim Scott's bill in the Senate. The Democrats, of course, think that doesn't go far enough. And there are a lot of places where the parties can compromise, as in chokeholds. But there are other areas, like getting rid of some of the immunity that police have legally, is going to be a much harder place to compromise.
Mm-hmm. NPR National Political Correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, schools across the country are working out how they might reopen in the fall, many implementing new safety protocols, changing just about every aspect of schooling. In Sausalito, California, one elementary school has been piloting in-person classes. KQED's Julia McAvoy went to see how it works.
Outside Bayside Martin Luther King Jr. Academy in Sausalito, parents are pulling up to drop their children off. They've been doing this since the end of May. Just inside the doorway into school, the school office manager, Julius Holdsclaw, waits to check them in. A kindergartner arrives, mask on, and gets a generous squirt of hand sanitizer.
1, 2, real good. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, real good.
So I've been managing staggered entries where the students are arriving by grade level or cohorts and approximately 10 to 15 minute intervals.
Holdsclaw also takes her temperature.
So have you had any cold, cough, or flu-like symptoms today or last night?
And asks her if she's been sick. Roughly 27 students have been consistently showing up to class. This experiment with in-school learning came about after the elementary school recognized it had a small number of students who were really having a hard time learning from home. Itoko Garcia is the Sausalito Marin City Schools superintendent.
Part of some of our students struggling to get their distance learning done is their parents were essential workers and they're still working.
It was really relief. And I was like, oh, thank you, guys.
Kim Lewis and her husband were trying to homeschool their first and third graders while watching their four-year-old. Lewis also leaves the house to work in a rehab center. So keeping track of the kids.
Sometimes the kids could be sneaky sometimes. They pretend they're doing their homework, but they don't.
Lewis said the school actually began calling her house.
If you don't answer or you don't follow up for a couple of days, the teacher will or the principal will knock on your door.
Knock on your door? Did that happen? They knocked on your door?
Oh, yes.
Lewis was grateful for the school's help, and she was happy to sign that release form for them to go to school after hearing of the safety procedures that the school had put into place. Two of her children are in classes no bigger than 10. Desks are spaced 6 feet apart. Superintendent Garcia says county public health officials said students under 12 don't have to wear masks, but the school encourages it.
Do you mind wearing the mask? Does it bother you?
Yeah, a little bit. It bothers me.
Roderick Bradley is in Brandon Cully's fifth grade class, along with his friend and his classmate, Byron Puertas. Roderick said it was relaxing being at home, but...
Like, you kind of miss school because you want to see your friends again. It's been so long.
This was a good idea.
Why do you think they thought that?
Because I get to, like, the teacher gets to help me. If I don't get something, I could just ask for help.
I really wanted to come back to work.
Cully was one of several teachers who volunteered to hold virtual classes from inside their classrooms. 80% of Cully's students were doing fine with distance learning, but 6 were not. And now he can help them in person from 9 to 11 a.m.
I'm a person-to-person kind of teacher, and it was just really odd to try to get it all done through Zoom.
But it's not lost on Cully that this is all a big risk. California is seeing outbreaks of COVID-19 on the rise, and we know the virus can go from adult to a child who then, asymptomatic, can spread it to others.
I'm questioning myself of how close do I get? You know, when's the last time I washed my hands? Like, use hand sanitizer. There's a lot of filtering going on that is hard to get used to, right? And I'm constantly worried about kids being human beings in the sense of being close and talking and touching, and that's been challenging.
This week, Superintendent Garcia is welcoming 80 students here for summer school. In the fall, it could be the entire school of 120 students. Garcia's convinced they can do this safely if there's enough investment by the state to create smaller class sizes. For Here and Now, I'm Julia McAvoy.
In the age of Zoom interviews, books convey credibility. In fact, libraries are being called on to send out books to fill shelves, but many are already populated with the huge volumes of Robert Caro. He is instant cred. His Pulitzer Prize-winning books on the brilliant but flawed New York builder Robert Moses and lawmaker then President Lyndon Johnson are considered the best in historical biography. The Power Broker about Moses and four books about Johnson with the fifth in the works weigh in at thousands of pages. Robert Caro spent years on each, tracking down families carelessly displaced by a Moses highway or moving his own family to the Texas Hill Country to understand the people Johnson came from. Both of Caro's subjects had power. Robert Caro found out why. Readers can now find out how he did that. In 2019, he published the slim, beautiful book Working, about how he researches, interviews, and writes. And Robert Caro joins us now on Skype. Welcome.
Nice to be here on Skype.
What did you think with your books showing up on those Zoom interviews?
To tell you the truth, that was sort of startling and humbling. My wife, Ina, noticed that. She said, the power broker's behind everybody's head. So you feel good about it, you know, because that book came out 46 years ago. And to see young political reporters using it now, that's sort of, to be honest with you, thrilling to me.
Well, and I was also thinking about the years you spent writing the book on Robert Moses, the man who ruled New York, building all the bridges, the parks, Jones Beach out on Long Island. He was like God, you know, he created New York in, you know, however many years. But you also felt insane. You had no money. Your wife, Ina, she's also your research partner, sells your home without telling you just to get cash. What kept you going?
The more I was finding out, the more I said, you know, no one understands how power works. I said, Robert Moses was never elected to anything. He held power for 44 years. How did he get that? I felt it was important to finish the book so that even if I never got to do another one, people would understand how power really works in cities.
And you learn right off the bat, one thing that's precious to the researcher you'd become, files. You're a young reporter at the great late Long Island Newsday. There's a battle over building an airport. You get a call on a Sunday. You're there alone. Someone at the FAA says, I like what your paper's doing. I'm just going to leave a door open and there's going to be some boxes on a table. And there you walk in and you have this treasure trove. Talk about that part of the work, the finding the papers.
Everyone else was at a picnic on Fire Island, so no one had a cell phone then, so I had to go myself. I remember I worked all night. I wrote a memo. Then I went home, and the phone rings, and it's the managing editor's secretary, and he was an old-time newspaper man who always looked me askance because I was from Princeton. His name was Alan Hathaway. She said, Alan wants to see you right away. So I said to my wife, I'm about to be fired.
But instead, he makes you an investigative reporter because of what you found in those files. You tell him, I don't know how to do that. He says, what?
He said, just remember one thing, turn every page. And I've remembered that and sort of tried to follow it all my life.
Well, no kidding. You'd later find Robert Moses papers tucked in a huge building in New York. You'd discover, you know, people making deals. Road gets moved. Moses' Northern Boulevard was supposed to go through this rich guy's private golf course. it juts down 4 miles away to, as you write, protect him from the hoi polloi. It leaves the rich alone and destroys this road, destroys these small farms. Now, you could have just written that, oh, this road was moved and it went through farms. But you didn't. You went and found the farmers.
That was a moment of awakening for me, Robin. It was the moment that I realized that if I really wanted to write about political power, I would have to write not only about the men who wielded power, who had power, I would have to write also about the powerless, the people who didn't have power and whose lives were affected either for good or for ill. And it came to me when I was interviewing one of these farmers, actually his son and his wife. He had died. And they said, the day Robert Moses took our farm was the day our lives were ruined. When you heard that, you suddenly said, that's an aspect of power too. What government can do for people and what it does to people.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned you and your wife, Ina, moved to the hill country in Texas to get closer to the people there who were very closed off. You're a New Yorker. And you decide, can anyone tell, that you have to move in and really, with your wife, get to know these women. And it's astonishing what you find out. There was no water, no electricity in this area till Lyndon Johnson brought it. Talk about not just discovering the hardship of these women's lives, but realizing if, you know, maybe their story wasn't going to get told.
The wells in the hill country are about 75 feet deep. That's the water table. And I remember one of these very elderly women saying to me, you're a city boy. So she went to her garage, and there was her old water bucket with the frayed rope still attached. She took me over to the well that was covered with boards. She pushed the boards off, and she dropped the bucket into the well. She said, now pull it up. And let me tell you, it was heavy. And there was this heavy bar of wood, like cattle wear, like cows wear. And she said, we put this on so we could carry buckets at a time. And then you know, I was from New York. And one thing I had noticed was the women of the hill country seemed to me to be much more stooped than city women. Mm. And I learned that their expression was bent. We got bent early. This one woman said to me, I swore I wasn't going to be bent like my mother. But as soon as my kids started to come and I had to carry the water, I knew I would look exactly like my mother looked. Mm. So Lyndon Johnson is a political genius. He's running for Congress and he finds the magic line. He says, if you elect me, I'll bring electricity to this country and you won't look like your mother looks. And it seemed impossible. There was no dam. There was no source of water power or any other power for electricity. A dam had been started on a river at the edge of it, but it was the Depression. The dam had stopped. And if they built the dam, how were they going to lay lines, thousands, tens of thousands of miles of lines across these empty hills to connect these scattered farms? But he persuaded the president, Franklin Roosevelt, to do it. And that was his first great achievement.
Robert Caro, you say you wanted people, readers, to see the epic, the grandeur, the majesty in the story you're telling. And by that, you meant, obviously, these people, these, you know, not just the power brokers, but the ones affected by them, but also the power brokers. You know, Moses, he built the bridges that make New York looked like a Christmas tree at night. He built the parks. He did these great things, but then terrible flaw, brutal to people who got in his way. Johnson, well, you just described what he did for the people of the Hill Country. He also rammed through civil rights legislation, but then fell because of his escalation of the Vietnam War. In places in the book, Working, you say how you when you think of each of them at certain times, you could just cry. How do you feel about these two men?
Oh, these are terrific questions. Mixed, well, you know. You take Lyndon Johnson. So now it's the last book in my series on Johnson. So, of course, Vietnam is a major part of it. And that's a tragedy. But you think also Johnson had a compassion for people and a genius for turning that compassion into government action. You know, Jack Kennedy is assassinated. 4 days later, Johnson has to make his first speech to a joint session of Congress. He's still living in his home, and down in the kitchen, four of his aides and speechwriters are around this kitchen table writing the speech. And they said, well, we're really not ready yet, but there's one thing we all agree on. Don't make civil rights a priority. If you do, you're going to antagonize the Southerners who control Congress. They're going to stop your legislative program just like they stopped Kennedy. Don't do it. And Johnson says to them, well, what the hell's the presidency for then? And he goes out and he makes his first speech and he says, my first priority is to pass Jack Kennedy's civil rights bill. And as he's saying it, he's saying it to this row of Southern senators sitting right in front of him. His fight for civil rights and voting rights is epic. It's an epic of triumph of what government can do, just as Vietnam is an epic of tragedy.
Hmm. Robert Carroll, I'm thinking of some of the tips that you give, and I'm going to abide by one. You say that when you're doing an interview, silence is a weapon, and you constantly write, as you're taking your deep notes, you constantly write the letters S-U. What does that mean?
It means shut up. I talk too much. So I learned that if you could just not talk, you ask a question and the guy doesn't want to answer it. One of the best things I found that I can do is not say the next line. You know, there's a silence and we're all human. We feel we want to fill it up. But if you don't fill it up, often they'll fill it up. And they'll fill it up with something they wouldn't otherwise have said. So, yeah, if you look through my notebooks, Robin, you'd see an awful lot of SUs written there.
I'm writing one to myself right now. Robert Carroll, again, his latest book is Working, Researching, Interviewing, Writing. It's a must read for anyone who wants to attempt to do any of those things and also has read his great volumes. He's been called the greatest political biographer of our times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Events around the world have been affected by the pandemic, and now that includes one of the biggest, the annual Islamic pilgrimage known as the Hajj. Because of the pandemic, Saudi Arabia is banning international pilgrims who normally visit Muslim holy sites each summer. Joining us now is the BBC's Samir Hashmi. He's on Skype from Dubai. Samir, how are people reacting to the fact that they won't be able to make this pilgrimage this year?
It's come as a bit of a disappointment for many people across the globe because when you talk about Hajj, more than 2 million Muslims from across the globe come down to visit Saudi Arabia and visit the holy sites. So it is one of the main pillars of Islam. For many people, it's a dream to go for Hajj or perform Hajj once in their lifetime. And they save money all their lives in many cases just to make that trip. So for all those who were ready and preparing themselves to make this pilgrimage, it has come as a huge disappointment. Though many people, if not all, were expecting that it would have been pretty unlikely for the Hajj to go ahead given the situation on the ground because of the coronavirus pandemic where the borders are still shut in many places. And even in Saudi Arabia, the number of cases have been pretty high when it comes to COVID-19. They've recorded over 161,000 cases and more than 1,300 deaths this year. Yeah.
But Saudis will still be able to do this. It's just people from the outside who won't, correct?
That's right. So the government has announced, the Saudi government has announced that they will be holding Hajj for a very limited number of people, and it will be only Saudi citizens and people will be tested before they are allowed to make this trip. It's going to be a symbolic Hajj. They're going to select very few people and take them for this pilgrimage.
Now, it is one of the most significant moments on the Muslim calendar. Just tell us, in a normal year, what is the significance of it and what does it look like when it happens?
For any Muslim who is healthy, in good physical shape, and is financially sound, it's mandatory for them to make this pilgrimage once in their lifetime. So a lot of Muslims across the globe, they prepare themselves to make this trip. And it's for 5 days. This pilgrimage is 5 days. It's spread across Makkah and Medina, the two holy cities. Makkah is where it starts. and it also ends in Mecca, and there are some other important holy sites where the pilgrims have to go. Now, what happens is that all of them travel at one point of time together to all these places. So we have more than 2 million people staying in the same area at the same time. So it's really crowded, and all of them are dressed in white robes for those 5 days. Before they come back to Mecca to end the pilgrimage. If you talk to a lot of Muslims, they describe this as a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and that's why it's so significant for the Muslim world.
So if it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, does that mean that the people that won't be able to go this year will try to go again next year or the year after that?
Well, that's right. That's what's going to happen most likely, though the Saudi government had issued a circular in April saying that asking Muslims around the world not to make the booking for Hajj this year, because it's a process. People have to start booking for it months in advance, since so many people have to come down. And there are quotas for every country, so they can only get X number of people depending on the population of that country. So those people would be allowed to apply next year. So it's not that that dream is over, but clearly for many of them who were hoping to make this pilgrimage this year, they won't be able to do that.
That is the BBC's Samir Hashmi joining us from Dubai. Samir, thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot.
The Challenger Deep is the deepest place in the ocean. It's in the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific. Only a handful of people have ever descended into it, and until this month, they were all men. Mountaineer Vanessa O'Brien is one of two American women who made the voyage earlier this month. Astronaut Kathy Sullivan is the other. O'Brien has now been to both the highest and lowest points on the Earth and joins us now from New York on Skype. Vanessa, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to speak with you.
Okay, well, I have a lot of questions for you, but first of all, what is it like down there in the deepest place in the ocean?
Well, it's really cool and very interesting. I mean, at first you feel like almost an intruder to a very foreign place. It's very serene, and it's almost like visiting the moon if it were underwater. It looks like sand, but you know it's sediment, because this is where the tectonic plates come together. So the oceanic plate slides under the continental plate. But as you're moving along and looking at the sediment, which looks like sand, you can see little things like crawling underneath. So you know there's life there. But it's curious what that life is, because it's dark. So whatever lives there doesn't need eyes, for example. And the pressure is so great. This is 16,000 pounds per square inch of pressure, or 8 tons. So, you know, I don't know if it's capable of having a vertebrae, for example, with that kind of pressure.
Well, and I know it takes about 4 hours to get down to the bottom. Do you see a lot of life along the way down?
So, you know, if you watch some of the YouTube videos, they're quite cheeky and very cute. What they do is they put the entire possibilities of all things you can see on the way down in one place, which is amazing, right? But the chance that it's going to be in your peripheral view on the way down is probably 0.00001%. Mm-hmm. So you don't see a lot when you're going down. The reality is, I think by the time I was done talking to the pilot, Victor Vescovo, and saying, oh, what's that? What's that? What's that? It was already dark. So it gets dark really, really fast.
Well, and you're in this little mini submarine called Limiting Factor. What is it like inside there?
So the coolest thing is actually, for me, the experience of actually getting into the hatch. You know, this porthole picks up and you're going down into this hatch. It's got little handholds on the sides, so your feet are kind of stepping down into this very, very, very long hatch. And at first, you're going in, and I'm fine, and then I get to my shoulders, and I'm like, oh no, am I actually going to fit? And then suddenly, you are dropping down into a seat, and my first impression, and I'm going to give away a little bit of an age range here, was an I Dream of Jeannie or Barbarella, because you're sitting in something that's a little bit like, wow. It's like a little bottle or a magical place. And part of what made me think of that was because lining the whole ceiling are these oxygen canisters. You know, they're white and they're tubular. And then there's all these lights, right, of the command centers. It's a little spaceshipy, but it's cozy. It's comfortable. But there's one big problem with it, and that's it's kind of 100% electrics going into water.
Right. And there was an issue with that. I will say, by the way, that I am not old enough to have watched I Dream of Jeannie when it actually was on the air, but I did see just about every episode on Nick at Night a long time ago. Now, I assume it's very difficult to be socially distant in this tiny vessel. So how do you deal with coronavirus?
Expeditions during an age of a global pandemic are an absolute nightmare. And who knew, right? So what ended up happening is the first thing was that the USS Theodore Roosevelt, which was a U.S. naval ship, which you might remember in the news, came into the port of Guam, dropping off a bunch of COVID-19 sailors. We were going to depart from Guam. So that made this whole expedition already at risk, because Guam did not want anybody coming into Guam once they had the COVID-19 problem. The second thing is that we didn't want to go onto a ship where we would potentially have a problem with COVID-19. So what we had people coming from 7 different countries and 5 states. So what we decided to do was to have everybody test for COVID before they came into the ship, and that would satisfy the government of Guam, that would satisfy the captain of the ship, that would satisfy Victor as the owner, and that would certainly take care of all the passengers' state of mind. Once we got onto the ship, all masks came off, and it seemed for that, 12 days, a bit of normalcy.
Mm-hmm. You have not only visited the depths of the ocean, you've also climbed the highest mountain. Is there a difference in your mind, or how do they compare?
I found, the process and experience of some things very similar, like the crampedness of a sub versus the crampedness of tents as you're going up. They're both low oxygen environments, so I can draw parallels that make it seem like you're almost doing the same thing. But the reality is that climbing Everest is a much more physical pursuit. Any high altitude mountain, although it looks physical, there's a lot more mental capability that goes into it, because whenever something is endurance oriented, there's a mind over matter aspect to it. So at some point, there's going to be something inside that says, turn around. This is uncomfortable. You're higher than you've ever been, and you've got to overcome that negative voice, a bit like running a marathon, if you will, where you just got to persevere and push through. And that's why I think, having that mindset that says, I can do this, and to overcome those little hurdles that try to set you back is important.
Before you became an adventurer, you were in the banking industry. I wonder how you look back on that experience now, given the things you've seen. Does it feel frivolous to deal with finance after you've sort of explored the heights and depths of the world?
Well, I'll tell you what business does when you turn to exploration is there's the softer skills, which you can use, like leadership and teamwork and those things, which of course transfer immediately into any expedition, but also risk management, can't be underplayed. That's very important in the dynamics of any exploration. And then the softer skills around people, teamwork, leadership, being able to make decisions, because things are never going to go as planned. So it's always important to be able to make a call and have, sort of that plan B, C, D, whatever is necessary to either turn around or save an expedition in a different way.
Well, and your business background also allowed you to finance this trip, right?
Yeah, I think you sometimes you have to be creative in how you do it. And sometimes either you can't, you have to put it off, you have to save for it, you have to look for sponsors. In most cases, what I've found is that expeditions tend to be a game of numbers, because there's going to be some X number of fixed costs, and you want to share those fixed costs over a certain number of people. It's more financially viable.
There was a scary moment when you were down there, and maybe we finish with that. Tell us what happened when you were down so far beneath the surface of the ocean.
We had some of the batteries run out. It was the batteries on the starboard side. And the nice thing about any equipment is that there's a lot of built-in redundancies. So the first thing is never panic. You know, there's plenty of oxygen. There's plenty of ways to get up if things were to really fail. We're certainly not going to swim up, put it that way. But we just started troubleshooting and thinking through, okay, you know, if the starboard batteries are off, can we borrow something from the other side, or can we shut off things and will it recharge itself? So you just start troubleshooting. And mostly what I'm doing is talking through things with the pilot and having him talk to me out loud, more from a psychological point of view too, because my job as a mission specialist was really to collect rocks, and that's what I trained on the robotic arm for, to take pictures, to, you know, survey. I think when things don't go according to plan, you want that person with you who's not going to panic, but who's going to just be that calm presence. You just have to remain really, really calm, especially calm, the most calm in the worst situations.
Well, we're glad that you're okay, and congratulations on your trip down to the Challenger Deep, deepest place in the ocean. Vanessa O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us.
No, it's great speaking to you. Thanks so much.
More than two dozen states are seeing an increase in new cases of COVID-19, and among them is Utah. As the Salt Lake Tribune puts it, the curve has shot up from a plateau to a red rock pillar over the past few weeks. The state epidemiologist warned in a pretty shocking memo, "We're getting to the point where the only viable option to manage spread and deaths is a complete shutdown a week from today." First, let's get the latest from Tribune reporter Aaron Alberti. Aaron, this is a relatively low populated state, so, you know, the overall numbers aren't as shocking as the fact that they have tripled, the number of cases have tripled over the past couple of weeks. What are the concerns?
Yeah, we've got new cases just rising a lot per population. We're in the top four states, or at least we were as of a couple of days ago. Public officials here are very worried. Hospitals are saying they anticipate running out of capacity in the next month or two. And as you said, our state epidemiologist has warned, if we don't do something now, we're going to have to just go back to total shutdown if we want to get a hold of this.
Well, what's going on? Most of the state we know is in a yellow code, meaning social distancing encouraged, but gatherings of 50 people are allowed in pools and movie theaters. Salt Lake is at orange. You can't have groups larger than 20. Is it that people aren't abiding by that? Are they not wearing masks? What's happening?
So, yeah, we're at yellow in most of the state right now, everywhere except for Salt Lake City. But that seems to have given people the impression that yellow means that it's actually safer, when our state epidemiologist has said, no, yellow actually means you're at a greater risk of getting coronavirus because things are less restricted. And I'm not sure that people are understanding that. If you go outside of Salt Lake City, as I understand it, very few people are wearing masks. And that's one of the things that health officials have called for, is a mandate for masks in the state.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. But meanwhile, your governor, Governor Herbert, tweeted he appreciated the memo from Dr. Angela Dunn, the epidemiologist. He vowed to work to slow this surge, but said he has no plans to shut down Utah's economy again, which health officials are calling for if this rise continues. Is there a feeling there might be a bit of a showdown here?
Well, the buck stops with the governor. Our legislature has made it so that municipalities can't impose their own restrictions. The governor has also said he does not intend to implement a mask mandate because it's too divisive.
Aaron Alberti, reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Utah Hospital Association has started the hashtag #MaskUpUtah. Martha Beach went further. She took out an emotional full-page ad in the Salt Lake Tribune on Sunday with the message, "Mask up for moms everywhere." It's a tribute to her mom, Mary Margaret Miller, who died of COVID-19 just June 9th. Martha joins us now, and I'm looking at these beautiful pictures of your mom. She looks like a pip. We're so sorry.
Thank you for your condolences. She was an amazing person, and those pictures are truly kind of show her personality.
Yeah, she's wearing a crown on her birthday and one of those funny wiggly heart things on Valentine's Day. You were notified by the state that she was COVID-19 death number 135, and you say in this ad Your family thought she was much more than a number. And then you go on to list the 135 attributes that she had. Do you mind just telling us some of those?
Sure. She was vibrant. She was compassionate and determined. She just made sure that you were taken care of. And her orbit was large. She reached so many people. And we felt kind of hopeless in the whole situation, a little bit helpless and crushed, you know, really, by everything that happened. And having this ad really just was somewhat on a healing for us, to be able to show the world that she wasn't just this number and reported as just in such, it felt so inhumane and indifferent, right, the way that the state has to report these. And we wanted to know that there was a life behind that number.
Yeah, and obit death notices are very big in Salt Lake City. This one, the biggest.
We wanted to go big. Yes.
Right. But it's more than that. You say mask up for moms everywhere. What else did you want to say here?
Well, you know, obviously we wanted to celebrate her life and honor her. And we are just so proud of the kind of person she was and the impact she had on everybody. And masking up for other people would be something she would just be naturally doing. She would say, you know, this could help somebody. I don't know all the science, but I think this could help somebody. And she would be saying, we should be doing this. You know, we don't know, you know, how she caught it, obviously, in the living, you know, assisted living facility. And we don't know, you know, if that person had a mask or not, but it just, now what we know now, and the science is showing this, it just seems like it's something that's easy to do. It shows support and respect for your fellow community members, and just is something we just hope other people's moms don't have, you know, families don't have to go through this.
Yeah, save someone else's mom.
Yeah.
That's Martha Beach. We'll link you to the ad her family took out in the Salt Lake Tribune, celebrating their mother, Mary Margaret Miller, and reminding people about masks. Martha, thank you so much for talking to us about it. And, you know, again, so sorry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your condolences.
Mask Up for Moms. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.